Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. The world looks upon Canada as a country rich in water resources, but a new scientific study indicates the Canadian prairies are headed for a catastrophic drought in the near future. Limnologist Dr. Bill Donahue and world-famous water ecologist Dr. David Schindler have just published their findings in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences Journal. And even they were shocked at what they discovered about the state of water in Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba. This story coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. The diaries of early voyageurs document summers when the North Saskatchewan River was so dry they couldn't even paddle it with their canoes. While this may seem like an extreme situation, historical analysis indicates this is more likely the norm for rivers on the prairies. And believe it or not, this past century has also been one of the wettest in the last 2,000 years. According to a study just published by water scientists Dr. David Schindler and Dr. Bill Donahue, we're long overdue for a major drought. And their research indicates not only are drier days ahead, but also that the amount of water flowing through our rivers has already declined to a crisis level. Dr. David Schindler holds a Killam Memorial Chair and is a professor of ecology at the University of Alberta.
Well, this is based on an analysis that Bill Donahue and I have been working on for about 4 years. We started with an analysis of river flows, looking at the summer flows, which are the period that we have maximum demand on our rivers in the southern part of Alberta. And we were shocked at how much the river flows had declined in the past 90 or so years. So having seen that, we started to look for causes, things like changing climate, warmer temperatures causing higher evaporation, declines in snowpacks, declining glacial flows because of glacial melt, but also the human factors, human withdrawals and changes to watersheds caused by bulldozing and filling of wetlands and the riparian stream bank areas. And the overall picture, when we took that and then forecasted using climate models as a base for what we see happening with warming and past population growth and industrial growth is what we see happening in the future because nobody's showing any signs of slowing down. It's not a very pretty picture.
Well, you say that you were shocked at how much the summer flows have declined. How much have they declined?
Well, the best case that we analyzed was the Athabasca River, where at Fort McMurray, the decline has only been about 20% to 30%, depending on when you start measuring the records. But that's above what will be the major withdrawals in the near future as the oil sands really get rolling because they're predicted to use about half the volume of the winter flow in the Athabasca when there's a dry year and they're at their peak. In fact, if they were operating at the level they are predicted to be by 2020, in 9 of the last 15 years, they would have taken half the flow of the Athabasca River. The worst case is the South Saskatchewan as measured at Saskatoon, and that river, of course, has three tributaries, all heavily subscribed, the Red Deer, the Bow, and the Old Man. All of the irrigation water from Alberta pretty well is taken from the Bow and the Old Man, and very little of that water gets back to the river. It's all evaporated or goes into crop production. And the Bow, in addition, has glacial sources that are very important in hot, dry summers that are dwindling very rapidly in the Bow and Hector glaciers. And in those same basins, we see declining snowpacks. Snow is on the ground for a shorter period of time, and the total snow that falls has been decreasing over time. And then looking ahead, we are expecting another 4 to 5 degrees of warming, depending on what our will to control greenhouse gases turns out to be. So overall, it's not a very rosy picture because evaporation increases in proportion to duration of the period above freezing and air temperature.
Why have we not noticed this before? What's different about the analysis that you've done?
There have been a number of past studies that have looked at annual flows, or what they call normalized flows, where they take the water that irrigation uses and pretend that it's back in the river, basically. And those flow patterns have declined very little. We're beginning to see some significant but small changes in the annual flows, but really they're not representative of the crisis that we're in, because our big water demand for southern rivers is in the summer, when the irrigators want the water, the lawn and garden people in cities want the water, and when we need the water for the cold water fisheries of rivers like the Bow and the Old Man.
So are we going to see these rivers drying up, especially downstream?
I think unless we act, we're going to see them effectively drying up by the time they get to places like Saskatoon. If you listen to some of my friends in Saskatchewan who canoe or kayak, who are complaining about having to drag their canoes where once there was lots of water, they've pretty well already dried up.
What do you see as being the implications for water quality?
Models that we developed in the 1970s to predict the degree of eutrophication, basically the over-fertilization of lakes that causes massive algal blooms, have had two ingredients: the amount of nutrients going in and the amount of water flushing the system. There are three major models in use, and they all have those same ingredients. People have fixed on the nutrient inputs and tried to reduce that. Nobody has paid much attention to water flow. Yet if you want to make your lake turn twice as green and nasty, you can either double the nutrients going in from things like sewage or manure or phosphate-based detergents, or you can cut the flows, have the flow rates, and it'll have the same effect. So we have all of these huge new sources of nutrients as our population and agriculture increase, but we also have these dramatically reduced flows. So with respect to water quality and the greening of lakes, so to speak, we're giving them a double whammy.
Now, you've looked at the human factors that go into this, but what about the historical factors? Is this part of a cycle, a natural cycle?
Part of it is, and this is what really got us thinking. Two of my colleagues, Dave Sauchin from the University of Regina and Peter Levitt, also from the University of Regina, have done analyses of drought conditions in centuries before the 20th. In Dave's case, he uses tree rings as the so-called proxy. Trees grow better when there's water. So dry years, there's very thin tree rings. In Peter's case, he's used algal remains deposited in lake sediments, which leave a fossil record that you can tease through to find the abundance of salinity-sensitive algae. Both have come to the same conclusion. The 20th century, which we think of as normal, was an unusually wet century. And for several centuries, perhaps as many as 20 centuries before that, we had droughts that lasted 30 or 40 years and more, and sometimes two or three droughts in a century. In contrast, when you apply their indices to the 20th century, even the drought of the dirty 30s is puny by comparison.
Well, if that's the case, then how dry could we really expect it to get? Does this mean that we're really overdue for a real drought?
I think it is. I think the chance of getting two centuries in a row that are unusually wet is pretty slim. I think most people are aware of John Palliser's trip to the prairies, and at least Palliser's triangle, that semi-arid triangle of land that extends over most of Alberta and Saskatchewan in the south. We now know from these studies that Palliser arrived near the end of a 40-year drought, and that the drought broke shortly after that, so that when settlers arrived, it was one of the wettest periods in the history of the prairies. So we know that if it's as dry as Palliser saw, with the abundance of people and agriculture and industry that we have now, even without climate warming and glacial melt, we'd have a pretty tough time on our hands. I think the prospect of 5.5 degrees more warming and a doubling of Alberta's population, which will happen very quickly, probably within 20 or 25 years at the rate we're going, and industry and agriculture increasing their water consumption in proportion, when you put all of those things together, it's not a rosy picture by any means.
Is there a fix? Are there things that we could or should be doing in the short term and the long term to change this situation?
Short term, I think the only thing we can do is really move rapidly to watershed conservation and water conservation. Every day that I drive across Alberta, I see teams of bulldozers out bulldozing forests and wetlands to turn them into either sites for new big box stores or new feedlots and other agriculture activities. And most people don't realize that those are key features that we need to recharge our groundwater aquifers and to clean the water before it seeps into lakes and rivers. So that's number one. Second is we could still do a lot to conserve our use of water. We still use more water than European countries by a factor of at least 2, and in some cases 4. And we could do a lot to choose industries and agricultural crops that don't require much water as well. And the final thing we could do is, rather than letting the big population explosion hit dry southern Alberta, we could offer incentives to get industry and people to move where the water is in the north, rather than letting them settle at random where they want to and then worrying about expensive diversions to get water to them.
Thank you very much, Dr. Schindler.
You're welcome, Cheryl.
That was Dr. David Schindler. He holds the Killam Memorial Chair and is a professor of ecology at the University of Alberta. He co-authored a study of Alberta's pending water crisis, and it has just been published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences Journal. The looming water crisis on the Canadian prairies will have wide-ranging implications for our economic and political stability. That's according to water scientist Dr. Bill Donahue. A former PhD student of Dr. David Schindler, Bill is now an independent researcher with his own company, Freshwater Research Limited. The two scientists have collaborated on a detailed analysis of summer water flows in prairie rivers. Their findings indicate the prairies are drying up at an even faster rate than we might have imagined. Their study has just been published in the scientific journal, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. I asked Bill how the project started.
Well, Dave sort of put me onto a project looking at Muriel Lake up near Bonnyville in sort of east-central Alberta, and the fact that it was disappearing and people wanted to know why. And they were thinking, well, it's industry, it's climate. There were a variety of opinions, but no one had actually done any studies. So I got involved in that, and in trying to tease apart what was happening up there, I started looking at the climate records and the water databases. And as I sort of branched away from the Bonnyville area, I realized that there was a much broader problem, not necessarily associated purely with what was going on in Muriel Lake, but it dawned on me that, you know, there was a pretty broad-scale changes in water supply and in climatic variables like temperature and snowpack and precipitation and stuff. So it sort of, its genesis was from there, and then it just kind of grew into a separate study from that. So,
well, what you've got now seems to be a pretty big picture of the water shortage that is looming before us. Why do you think we haven't looked at that before?
I think part of the problem is that, or part of the reason is that scientists in general sort of try and reduce everything to the most easily explained unit at a very small scale and try and explain things in detail. And certainly funding for government programs, you know, they do some monitoring that's been cut, but there's not a lot of program money for actually doing research. So there's no one that was just kind of putting pieces together and looking at the big picture. And as a result, it remained just to be sort of discovered and looked at on the large scale.
How did you actually do the study then? What were you looking at?
Well, initially I looked at stream flows and lake levels and that sort of thing. And there are shortcomings in the databases. In a lot of systems, you know, there's no year-round monitoring with regards to stream flow or, say, climatic variables. And so I looked at spring and summer river flows, and then in terms of climatic variables, things like temperature, winter temperature, summer temperature, precipitation, snowfall, snowpack, just as many different things as I could to try and figure out what was going on. And then with regards to this paper, we just sort of selected a few, about 10 different sites across the prairies, and focused on those just to kind of simplify the story, and then also major rivers. So this paper is very much an overview of what's going on. There's a lot more stuff that we hope to do in the next year in terms of additional papers that are kind of much more detailed and much more process-oriented. But this first paper was just kind of the big picture thing and what's been going on in the past. Looked at some climate models that have been generated out of the University of Victoria for future potential change in the prairies, and we kind of tied them together. What has happened in the past, what's the state of water now, and where might we end up in the future?
As you started doing this number crunching and the story began to evolve, what was your reaction?
Shock, excitement, just the fact that there were, especially, say, the South Saskatchewan system, Saskatoon was the big one where, you know, you see summer flows that are declined by 85% in the last century. It was just really surprising to find these major changes and the fact that they really hadn't been looked at before. And, I mean, part of what we did in terms of looking at summer also, usually people have looked at total annual flows, sort of thinking, well, the total annual amount of water that flows past a point in a river, if that hasn't changed much, you know, it means that there's no problems. But a lot of what we do with dams and other things that in terms of uses of water means that we've really shifted when the water is in the river. So, for example, in the Peace, there's now a lot more water in the winter than in the summer, or in the winter than used to be in the winter because of the Bennett Dam and the fact they hold back water and they release it in the winter. Ecologically, that summer flow is critical because that's when, you know, naturally and in terms of our own consumption, there's a big demand for water. And so you get increases in river temperature and all kinds of other things when the flows are quite low. So in those regards, there have just been major changes, and it was surprising the scale of change and the fact that it's happening everywhere.
There are implications for water supply, implications for water quality. But what are the implications from an economical and a political point of view?
Ultimately, I think this is basically a warning that if we continue to do things the way we have, sort of an ad hoc basis, not considering the big picture in terms of the sorts of things that we rely on economically. I mean, we've got all these industries and Alberta is just booming. It's sort of the global story in terms of economics. But things like oil and gas development, especially heavy oil and oil sands, and things like agriculture are highly water intensive right now. And so we're sort of awash in all this cash now, and we're sort of assume that these fundamental things that these industries rely on, such as water, will just kind of continue. However, it's likely that they're not going to. The supply is going down as demand is going up. And I guess the question is, you know, how much are we willing to sacrifice to continue to fuel some of these industries with water? It's ultimately, politically, they're going to need to start prioritizing things because conflicts are going to arise between different water users within the province, as well as interjurisdictional. So between provinces, between here in Saskatchewan and Manitoba, the Northwest Territories, Aboriginal groups who rely on things like the Peace-Athabasca Delta for their livelihood. There are a lot of potential conflicts and implications of declining water supply at the same time as our demand is increasing. And if we return to some of the mega droughts this part of the world has experienced in the last 2,000 years, we could be in for some major, major risks. And politically, they're going to have some tough decisions to make. And they need to start making those decisions in terms of a long-term plan.
Well, when you look at this historically, what were some of these past droughts like?
Well, we think of the droughts in the 20th century or in the last couple of years as pretty extreme. They're the most extreme droughts that we've experienced in the prairies. However, that's primarily because at least sort of, you know, Europeans have been on the prairies for 100, 150 years. Studies out of the University of Regina and Queen's University have sort of reproduced climate and water supply in the prairies over the last 2,000 years by looking at changes in different sorts of biological and chemical indicators that are stored in lake sediments. And they've realized that the 20th century was unusually wet and unusually stable climatically, and that the norm actually for the region is that, you know, in most centuries there have been droughts that have lasted a decade or longer, up to maybe 30, 40 years. So we've just kind of come along at the same time. We've had this sort of fluke of a lot of moisture and a very stable climate that we've been able to come to rely on in terms of farming and industrial development and everything else, and we've allowed development to proceed as if this is normal. So if we return to historical variability and intensity of droughts and that sort of thing, we stand to be exposed to some major risks and some major shortfalls in water supply. In the mid to late 1800s, there wasn't enough water in the North Saskatchewan River to float a canoe, according to some of the diaries that came from that period. So we stand to look at some pretty major changes. And then when you throw in climate change and what we've been experiencing the last 30 years, the rate of change has been increasing dramatically in terms of water supply, warming, declines in snowpack, declines in precipitation. So it'll be potentially a pretty bad story.
What do you want to see coming out of this, the work that you've done?
I'm hoping first, I guess, that people just kind of take it as a wake-up call. We really need to change how we do things in the prairies. And we really need to plan for kind of a large-scale, spatially large-scale planning for development. Recognize the need that perhaps, in terms of risk management, we decide that, you know, we maybe need to start limiting development and doing legitimate environmental impact assessments. As it is now, environmental impact assessments are kind of considered a game politically and in industry. You jump through some hoops, and, you better not interfere with our development because, well, we've already planned it and we've already invested and all those sorts of things. Ultimately, a lot of these projects likely aren't sustainable in the long run because of water supply. Conceivably, if we get into, a 10 or 15 year drought, all bets are off in terms of industries that rely on water. So I would like sort of, people to realize that that's what we're facing. And I would like governments to start walking the walk in addition to talking the talk when it comes to funding freshwater research. A lot of what we're relying on, we know very little of when it comes to the state of water. Groundwater supplies, surface water supplies, monitoring programs have been cut dramatically since the early 90s, both federally and provincially. We have some regulations and laws that are good, but there's almost no enforcement of them. So they really need to start paying more attention to water, since everything in this part of the world relies on it, and the supplies are declining.
What is it in the research that you did do in this paper that's published now that stands out to you that needs more work?
Well, I would say in terms of the future, which is sort of why I've looked at some of these kind of more models of the connections between water supply and climate variables, I'd say more work needs to be done on what we're looking at. I'd say a lot of the research, say, with regards to the government, needs to go into monitoring. They need to tie together and integrate the state of groundwater and kind of produce a data set or just a repository for data that can be accessed easily, which is well organized and can be accessed by people within and outside government at the same time. As it is now, there's a lot of information out there, but a lot of it is sort of all over the place. Like, people that do seismic work have got lots of water information, but we have no idea where that information is. And in terms of stream flow, monitoring of climatic variables, of snowpack, of precipitation, of evaporation, I think there needs to be some significant investment in those sorts of things, just because those programs have suffered cuts in the past. There was one of the few monitoring stations, for example, was at the outflow of one of the major glaciers in the Rockies, and monitoring of it stopped in 97. So we really have no idea what's been going on since then. when it comes to outflows from glaciers at the headwaters of the Athabasca. So it makes it much more difficult now when we're getting to these points where things are, you know, conceivably heading to a breaking point when we run into absence of information. You know, no snowpack data or no streamflow data or not enough climatic data on a broad scale. And then someone comes along and says, well, what's going on? And all we can do is sort of guess and say, well, we're not really sure because we don't have the data. So I'd say the biggest thing would probably be monitoring and then enforcement and then sort of the research in terms of the mechanisms of how things are changing and why, and tying together groundwater and surface water and climate with all of the uses that we're doing.
Who funded your research?
That would be me. I did. There was a little bit that came from the Gordon Foundation through Dave, a foundation in the States, a charitable foundation that gave him some money. But the majority of it was from me.
So funding is definitely an issue when it comes to water, lack of funding.
Oh, it's a major thing. And I think part of it is because in Canada, we seem to be under the impression that we've got lots of water. We're water wealthy. And everyone just kind of presumes that. There's no question of that. And it's evident that that's not the case, at least, say, in the prairies. I mean, the Canadian Shield may be a different story. But there are certainly regions where water is a major issue and will continue to be. And I think people need to understand that we're not water rich. You know, just because you turn the tap on and water comes out doesn't mean that there aren't some problems with fresh water.
Thank you very much, Bill.
You're very welcome.
That was Dr. Bill Donahue of Freshwater Research Limited. He and University of Alberta water ecologist Dr. David Schindler have co-authored a study on the prairie water crisis. This was recently published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Sustainable Forest Management Network, the Alberta Conservation Association, the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Innovation and Science, Alberta Gaming Research Institute, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Research Council, Calgary Technologies Inc., Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, Science Alberta Foundation, Ducks Unlimited Canada, and the NSERC ACR Integrated Landscape Management Research Chair. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.